You're listening to a Weeby Geeks Network podcast.
Hey, this is Billy West. Sometimes I play Philip Jake Fry. Man, all this constant exposure to radiation's making me thirsty.
I'm Dr. Zoidberg. Are you gonna eat that?
And Zap Brannigan. Gif, alert the men. I've made it with a woman. Good news, everyone. Bad news.
By the way, I'm Billy West, if you forgot already. And you're listening to Weeby Geeks podcast. You're home for this sort of thing.
And it is another episode of Weeby Geeks, your voice of the geek revolution. Now, we always say it, you wanted the best, you got us.
Sorry.
So it is Marty and Mike, your off-tone, auto-tuned voices for the next however long.
I have no clue.
So what's new?
Well, as a matter of fact, I just got back from a nice screening, a nice sneak peek of Guardians of the Galaxy.
And how was it?
It was good. It was good. I'm going to go out there and say, you know, with all preface, the Marvel space stories, characters never really interested me, so I can't say I've got a huge background in all the characters that I saw on screen, and there were quite a few. But yeah, it was a solid movie. Well done. It's got the, you know, it's got the Marvel flavor to it through and through, where, I mean, they were not afraid to throw some new characters and new comic book terminology, like the Kree, Nova Corps, things like this at you that we've never been introduced before. So, bold move.
Well, they have actually mentioned briefly the Kree, or alluded to the Kree in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Ah, see? There you go.
With Tahiti.
Right.
So, supposedly that was part...
Very briefly, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So...
So, that's... I'll definitely... It's one of those where I'm really interested to see how the general public's going to... Not just the nerd community is going to get behind it. It's good enough for them to get behind. But I'm curious how, like, the general populace that doesn't have a character that they already know from, like, T-shirt or, you know, a lunch box or something like that, how will they feel about it, though? Right. For me, like, personal rankings, you know, to me, Avengers and Captain America 2 still rank, like, top. Iron Man, those three still rank amongst my top. It doesn't hit those yet. Guardians, to me,
top five.
The guy, I'm gonna say, yeah, not even top five, but okay. That's, you know, still good. But like I said, it makes it sound like it's not good, but it's still good. Like, the guy I was with, it turns out that's his favorite Marvel now. He enjoyed it that much. So it's just like, to me, those are the three that I think of the Marvel movies is like, boom, these are awesome. You gotta see these. Guardians good, just not there.
Okay. Well, I know you always hate me for this, but I have another surprise.
Another surprise.
So, we'll see if any of these might ring a bell.
Thanks are not necessary. It is my duty to oppose the minions of Aku, and my mission to vanquish the very demon himself.
Hello, fellow children! Bulby worship giant space rock!
Bulby spiritual.
For a rookie, you did well, Static. But I can tell you're going to be a handful when you finally join the league.
I'm sorry, did you say when I joined the league?
Oh, sorry, I've been fixing this antique crystal chandelier for Frankie. This is the last piece.
Welcome, brother. May the blessings of the season be upon you.
You're now the proud owner of Bamboo Boogie Boots. With a warning label this big, you know they gotta be fun.
But Pops, I don't want to have fun. I want to be like you, boring but prudently invested.
I've come to my senses. You should do the same.
Any of those ring a bell?
Oh, just most of my adolescence and college watching entertainment. All just came back to me right there.
Of course, I didn't get to one of my other personal favorites, which is Kit Fisto. But we are being joined by Phil Lamar. How are you doing tonight, Phil?
Yay. I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
Good. Hopefully, we didn't embarrass you too much with that little flashback.
No, that's funny. that's funny you mentioned Kit Fisto. I don't know that I have any clips from Clone Wars. I guess I'm a little behind on updating my audio reel.
And I thought you were going to say Disney took those all away when they bought Star Wars. They took all the rights to your voices as well.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. Whenever I try to post anything on YouTube, like stuff, there'll be thousands of clips up there from Mad TV or whatever. But the minute I try to post one, pull down immediately.
Yeah. It's me, guys. I was that person.
I feel like somebody's watching me.
I've heard that from quite a few different celebrities on Facebook or on Twitter saying, I posted it and it got taken down because I didn't own the rights. It's like, it's my thing. Of course I own the rights.
No, but that's the whole thing. And that's why it's tricky at conventions sometimes. You know, people want you to do the voices. And the truth of the matter is, they're not our characters. We didn't write them and we don't own them. And the voices, you know, essentially it's our voice, but that character is, you know, considered a work for hire. You have no creative rights to it unless you wrote it or produced it. Okay. You know, which is weird. But that's the thing in voiceover. Every time you work on a cartoon, they give you a day contract.
Hmm.
I mean, I think it's just because it's the way, but I think it's also a subtle reminder that you're replaceable. You're here today. You may not be here tomorrow.
You're just a guy with the funny voices. We got a bunch of them in the back.
Exactly.
Well, I guess to hit up some of the stuff you're doing presently. I thought I read somewhere you're working on a webisode project called Not For Hire.
Not really. That buddy of mine called me 6 years ago and said, hey, will you be part of this? I'm like, sure. And that was the last I heard, except that it shows up on IMDb and keeps moving to in pre-production. No, I guess because it hasn't been done yet, it always stays at the top of the thing because it's in pre-production. But as far as I've done no work for it, it's a great concept, and I guess he's got Ben Browder attached to do it, and I guess maybe he's still looking for money, because it's supposed to be a live action thing, but set in a future world where, you know, artificial intelligence is, you know, the thing, and all of the mechanical things like that we have in our life today, cars, coffee makers, elevators, they all have AI. So they all have personalities and voices.
Okay.
So that's why I'm listed on there. I'm supposed to be the voice of something.
A toaster.
So then I guess we'll pose the next question. What are you currently working on?
Let's see. I'm working on Turbo Fast, this animated series for DreamWorks and Netflix, based on the Racing Snail movie from the other year.
Right.
Yeah, there are a bunch of us. Eric Bauza is on that. Amir Talai, Reed Scott from Veep. Yeah, we're doing those episodes right now. What else am I working on? It's very strange. These days, everybody has decided that every studio is the Pentagon, and you're not allowed to talk about anything. It's like, really? It's a cartoon. Turbo... I did a web series a year or so ago called Inside the Legend, which was sort of an on-camera thing. It was not sketch, but a very character-oriented thing, and that was a lot of fun.
Okay.
Got to do some writing and producing on that. So that I might own the rights to. what else? Doing an improv show with some friends of mine here in LA, but we've turned it into sort of a podcast called Blackout Television. Because we had so much fun improvising on stage that, you know, we decided to start improvising and record it. So we basically take a couple of different formats, like a Black Today show, you know, a Black Judge Judy show, and we come up with a couple of little ideas and then start rolling and just improvise the whole episode of one of these shows. And that one's fun. That's over at blackouttelevision.com.
Is it kind of a behind the scenes sort of look at it, or is it you guys just actually performing a full show in podcast?
We're actually performing a full show. Like, you know, we'll do the Morning Blackout. Hello, I'm Brett Williams. Welcome to Morning Blackout. And we'll do, you know, a segment, a cooking segment, and then a medical segment. Then we'll go to commercial. And in the commercials, you're behind the scenes. Like, everyone's all cheery, and then they go, and we're clear. It's like, what are you guys doing? Jesus, you know. So yeah, that one we have a lot of fun with.
That's cool.
And where can people find that show?
There's a Blackout Television app for Android and for iPhone, and then there's the website blackouttelevision.com.
Okay.
It's got all the episodes plus links to the apps.
Okay. Now, I guess we let's go back to the beginning. How did you
make get? Sure you, I was gonna say how
far back do we want to go?
That has the IMDb page of Mount Everest here, because you can pretty much name a show or a character that's in pop culture, and more than likely you've at least, you know, 7 degrees connected yourself to that character.
I started out, actually, my very first professional job was, weirdly enough, in animation, but it was sort of happenstance. There was a cartoon that was using actual kids. And I auditioned for it and got the job and did it for 3 summers. But then I went away to college and didn't really, I came back to LA and started an acting career, but I didn't get back into on camera into voiceover for another, what was that, 8, 5? Another 12, 15 years, you know, after that first job. You know? But yeah, I did the Mr. T cartoon. Was my very first job.
Oh, wow. Well, it's funny you mentioned Mr. T. We just chatted last week with one of the background artists of Mr. T, Bruce Zick.
Wait, he was a background artist on that Mr. T cartoon?
Yeah.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'll call that guy. I mean, I have not rewatched any of those episodes, but I remember it was not the height of the form, let's say. You know, I mean, basically it was like Mr. T was really popular. They said, well, he's got a serial, got a you know, primetime show. What else does he need? Well, we have action figure? Yeah. What about a cartoon? Okay. This is Mr. T. And it's just ridiculous. He would open the show live action. Now, kids, there's something you need to know. Whenever you're faced with trouble, make sure you ask for help when you need it. You know, something like, there was always like a whirl.
Yeah.
Although
yeah.
It usually had nothing to do with the episode. There's one guy who was writing the live action things, and Mr. T always wanted those to be, you know, to have a moral and to teach kids something. The part in the middle is that, dude, we're just trying to get 22 minutes. And it was a bad ripoff of Scooby-Doo. Like, Mr. Yep. T was the coach of a traveling gymnastics team, which went around the country solving mysteries. Like, why would a kid's gymnastic team solve mysteries? But then again, why would a guy in an ascot, 2 chicks, and a hippie solve mysteries either?
Right.
Or take a look at Clue Club. So, from there... So you started off with Mr. T and then went to in front of the camera?
After I came back to L.A. after college, I was doing primarily on-camera work, some comedy stuff, some drama. What did I do? I did like all those shows in the 80s and 90s, Murphy Brown, Wings, a lot of shows that have since, you know, gone by the wayside. There were a handful of great shows that I never got a chance to do. Like, I was always bummed that I never got to do a Seinfeld or a Friends. But, you know, can't be greedy.
So then you get to, what, Mad TV at some point?
Yeah, the mid-90s, we started doing Mad TV. And, you know, that was great. I mean, one, it was a steady job for 5 years. And, you know, I got to use all of the... sketch comedy and character stuff that I've been doing on stage at the Groundling Theater in L.A.
Okay.
You ever heard of the Groundlings?
Yes. Yep.
It's like, well, Will Ferrell and Kristen Wiig and Phil Hartman came out of there. You know, so many fantastic people. Lisa Kudrow, Kathy Griffin. And I got to use, you know, all the stuff that I'd been, you know, working on for years. Finally, we got to do it. Although I have to tell you, like, doing an hour of sketch comedy a week is work. I mean, it's not digging ditches, but, you know, you also have much less, you know, chance for failure while digging ditches.
In front of millions of people.
You know?
Right.
But, yeah, I always liken sketch comedy to baseball. If you get 1 out of 3 that are really funny, then you're like, those are Hall of Fame numbers.
Sure.
So the truth of the matter is, you need an hour of material every week. And after a while, like, we all have a couple of good ideas, then we get to our so-so ideas. You know?
Get to the one that you just kind of thought of while you were taking a shower and hope that...
Right. No. And, you know, it's funny, because in the beginning of the show, they would have the index cards of all the sketches we did, and there would be all the ones that were in the show. And then there were a bunch of sketches that just, you know, they wrote, but then didn't shoot. Then they're the ones they shot, but then didn't air. It's like, it's not good enough. By the time we got to third season, fourth season, there was nothing in the it's not good enough pile anymore. Yeah, stick that in like the last 15 minutes.
What was the audition process like going to Mad TV? Because I've heard a lot of stories of people auditioning for SNL and like how just kind of, I mean, the process is like they got two or three different scenarios, you do it, and most of it's all mental, where it's mind wracking, and the comedians are usually kind of second guessing themselves. Was there anything like that when you auditioned for Mad TV?
No, from what I understand, Saturday Night Live sort of has the market cornered on mind games. ours was just really more of a straight up obstacle course. you had to come in one time and, you know, they said you have 3 minutes, do, you know, at least three characters, three impressions, and something like that. You do that first. Then they say, okay, is he funny at all? Then they bring you back. I think we had to do that again for somebody else, because it's all like going through, you know, hoops. Then for the third hoop, you come back and then they give you some of their sketches, that you have to show that you can, you know, actually read, because, you know, there are a lot of stand-up comics who can be absolutely hilarious, but then you don't realize this guy's been doing this 25 minutes of material for 8 years. You know, can he be funny? Can he be funny with something new, you know, that he hasn't been able to, you know, shape like the McLennan? So they try you out with sketch work. Can they act?
Okay.
Then, hoop number four, they bring you in with other actors, and you do your don't know, and then you do your, you know, dog and pony show of your characters and impressions again. And then, and all this time, they're cutting people and winnowing it down, and then finally it's like, all right, now, do the dog and pony show, do the mix and match, but now do it for, you know, Quincy Jones, the producer. And then if he signs off on you, then you come back again and you do it in front of everyone at Fox.
It sounds like, you know, the final challenge in Steve Austin's new show.
Yeah, that's really what it is. It's, I mean, it's literally an obstacle course.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's a marathon is what it sounds like.
And I heard that it got even worse after years after us, because I was very first cast and they were just sort of like, okay, sure, let's try that. Years after that, they were bringing in like tons of people, because once a show's on the air, more people are willing to try out for it. So now they've got, you know, instead of 30 people to winnow it down to 8, now they've got 300, and they've got people traveling to comedy shows, you know, in Austin and, you know, Minneapolis and wherever, you know, and people feel like, I think there's even more pressure because now you've got something to lose. When we auditioned, it was some producer's pipe dream. It's like, well, we're doing this one episode. Hopefully we'll have more. But once the show's been on the air for 2 years, you know, now people are seeing dollar signs and like, ooh, if I get this job, I might be able to pay my rent for 6 months. You know?
Was there any point, after like season two or season three that y'all felt you had SNL running scared?
No, never. Absolutely not. No.
They pitted you guys, well, at least, you know, entertainment magazines and stuff. They always pitted it like the next SNL contender is Mad TV. And they would, you know, it was almost like Leno Letterman kind of yeah. Face off made it seem like.
Yeah. That was a PR move, which wasn't dumb, because how else do you get people talking about a sketch comedy show? There hadn't really been a new sketch comedy show. I mean, I think Dana Carvey had done a show a few years before that in living color, you know, but nobody really cares about sketch comedy as sketch comedy. It's like, who's in it? And we had no stars. So the only way to get any press was to have this sort of false hubris saying, we're the show that's going to take down Saturday Night Live. And it's funny because the year we did it, SNL was having a rebuilding year. They had just, like, you know, they had gone through a year where everybody said, oh, it's dead, it's dying. They fired everybody, and they brought on all these new people that nobody knew, so they seemed ripe for the picking, you know, from a PR standpoint.
Right.
Of course, the people they brought in that same year that we started Mad TV were Sherry O'Terry, Will Ferrell, you know, like all of these people who go on to be, you know, brand names in comedy.
Mm-hmm. And of course, all people I didn't really pay attention to until after Mad TV was gone.
Good. You were the demographic we were shooting for.
I was. It was like Mad TV, SNL. I'm taking Mad TV.
That's so funny. Yeah, I really wish that we had, I mean, the PR angle for that is fine. Like, yeah, we're taking on SNL. But I wish that the people running the show hadn't bought into it and had sort of like, let's just find our own vision. You know, we've got the mad brand, you know, so we've got the pop culture parody aspect. And really at the beginning, they did that, you know, to right. a certain degree. We had some great film parodies. I mean, one of my favorite sketches was, which Terminator was? I guess it was at the time Terminator 3. And it was the Terminator goes back in time, not to save John Connor, but to save Jesus.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And, you know, and Jesus keeps telling, no, I'm supposed to die. It's ordained.
No, why are you doing? I'm here to save you.
You know, and it was such a great sketch because I know that sounds kind of, but it was really respectful and accurate to the Gospels. Like, you know, the Terminator is blasting people with a shotgun and Jesus is healing him saying, thou shalt not kill. Like, everybody was true to their character. And, you know, to me, it's one of my favorite sketches. What's that? Go ahead.
I was going to say one of my other favorite ones was right around the time of, I want to say 9/11, the whole Steve Jobs with the Iraq.
Wow. Oh, my God. You know what? You just reminded me of the fact that I dodged that. Like, seriously, I left the show before 9/11. And I'm trying to think now what that would have been like to try to come up with sketch ideas, especially during that time. I'm glad to have dodged that bullet.
Yeah, because it was a time when football even shut down. So if football can't operate on a Sunday, how does comedy fit into the
And that's the thing. I mean, and you had to be very careful comedically. Right. You know, people wanted something light, but you couldn't touch on anything, you know, that seemed to be like mocking or disrespecting, you know, so many things. So right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that sketch came out like sometime after the first of the year.
Right, right.
But,
wow, that's amazing.
A question I've always been curious about. We find out with the movie Man on the Moon that, you know, the Lawler-Kaufman deal was a work or a bit. Was it the same way with Will Sasso and Bret Hart, or was there legit heat there? Because it's always hard to tell with Bret Hart.
Oh, Mike.
Hey, I just remember the look on your face when Bret double-palmed you across the set.
Staying silent.
No, dude. It was a sketch comedy show. But I love the fact that, because that was Will's idea, was to tap into the wrestling. And it's funny because it's a really different, it's not a different audience, it's actually the same audience, but it's a different experience as audience. Like, right. When you're watching a sketch show, you assume all of it is fake. And when you're watching wrestling, you know, well, I mean, I know some of it isn't real, otherwise they would totally, like, kill each other. But, like, in your heart, you kind of believe a lot more of it than you really should. And it was weird when we brought the wrestling into the sketch, because we had to play it completely straight. But yeah, none of it was real.
I remember MadTV used to pop in quite a few wrestlers. I think like Stone Cold would be on there and Bret Hart, and it seemed like a pretty good working relationship with the WWE at the time.
Yeah, it was all Sasso. Because Sasso was a real straight up wrestling fan. And he was just so jazzed to be able to meet all those guys and to go and be part of WWE. I mean, you know, us older guys didn't really get it. Bret Hart was so cool, you know. I still have a picture that I got to take with him as the UPS guy. it was so much fun. And certainly, you know, I think that was fourth or fifth season, it was a welcome, you know, change from just, you know, run-of-the-mill, here's a skit about a funny concept that somebody in the writer's room pitched. You know, it was something cool to do. Yeah, and I remember that. I remember that fall, and that was such a blast, you know.
Yeah, how did UPS Man come about? Because I know for MadTV, that was one of your more popular characters.
Yeah, that was something I used to do at the Groundlings. That's a character on TV, and I'm sure it was one of the things that helped me get the job. No, it's funny because we do lots of characters on stage and on stuff. Once in a while, if you're really lucky, you stumble onto something that people respond to. A few years back, I did the Pee Wee Herman show on stage, and I got to talk with Paul Rubens a little bit about the Pee Wee character, and he said the same things. Like, I did so many characters, you know, many of which I thought were much funnier than that one. But there was something about it. Like, you get on stage and you do the character the same way you do so many other sketches and characters, but the audience comes back with something totally different. You're like, whoa. And you realize that you've tapped into a nerve. And the UPS guy, that character wasn't a character originally. It was just a sketch. Like, I wanted a character. I had an idea for a sketch of a guy hitting on a woman, but he's so oblivious that he doesn't realize he's out of his league. And that's why he succeeds. And so I'm like thinking, okay, so like, what's some sort of like blue collar dude? And then like this really like classy, beautiful, professional woman. And okay, well, maybe she's like a lady lawyer and like a high rise. Okay, well, what could he be? Like, at first he was going to be a bike messenger because I thought that would be funny, like with the helmet on and like the bike shorts. I'm like, oh, hey, you know, the clacky shoes. Hey, you're pretty hot. But then it was like, no, she'd never let the dude who looks like that get into her office. Who could get into an office? Like, oh, UPS guys. They can go anywhere, you know? And that's a pretty funny look too, the brown shorts and, you know, all right. And it was literally just to serve the premise of the sketch. But then the character just sort of, you know, came out like this, like, you know, because I knew he was sort of a dumb dude, you know, because, oh, I don't get it. Totally, I don't really. You're hot. I'm hot. Let's do this. Whatever, you know. But then I don't know where I can't remember exactly where the physical stuff came from. I guess it was sort of to separate him from her even more because she was focused and she was direct and smart. And, well, not only was he dumb, but he's like, ooh, what's that? Ooh, you're like a goldfish in a bowl, like. You know, no attention span. It's like, and then like, okay, well, how do you physicalize that? Like, well, maybe if he's like jumping around the room every time his brain jumps somewhere, his body does too. Hell, cool. What? What'd you say? Oh, totally. Yeah. You know, and again, I came on to do just like this premise, this idea I had that I thought was funny. And then the character really clicked, you know, and then I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to leave this behind. Let's see if we can do more with this.
Did you find that happened a decent amount on the show, or most of the time the characters that really worked were the ones that the guys had worked on before the show started?
I mean, the biggest characters were definitely ones that people, I mean, Stewart and Mike, I used to do shows with Mike McDonald and he would do that Stewart character and it always killed.
Yeah.
No, stop. Let me do it.
Like, from day one. It was also one of those characters that just people responded to. I think Alex Borstein used to do the Miss Swan character on stage. You know, there's just something about it. You try, and especially once you're on the show, you know, we're trying to do new characters, and it's rare that you find one that hits in that way, you know? And I'm trying to think of if I had any others. Not really. I mean, we had the Funky Walker, Dirty Talker character, which was fun. But, and also maybe it's the fact that you don't have a live audience, so you can't really gauge how people are responding to it. Right. You know, like if you have an audience of 100 and 60 of those people really just vibe a character, you feel it. But like once you put something on TV and a million people are watching it at once, you know, I had a buddy who used to joke that you could take a grapefruit, sit it on a table and film it. And if you put that up on cable access, like every day, you know, every week for 3 months, eventually, if you sit a grapefruit on a table out on the street, somebody's going to go, oh, look, it's that grapefruit from TV. You know, like, why are you excited about that? I don't know, because it's on TV. So maybe it's just that you can't get that real response, you know, once you're on the show. But I don't know. It's I don't remember any of the shows, the characters we created on camera being as great as the ones that people brought in.
Right.
But you never know.
Well, another great character a lot of people might remember you from is from Pulp Fiction.
Ah, well, great movie. I don't know how great a character. Let's call it a small yet significant part.
It, very, very impactful.
Right.
Wow.
See this thing that he just put out? I think within the last week, somebody, there is a Marvin action figure, but it's headless. It's headless. It is like, it's this blood spattered thing with no head. and it comes complete with brain pieces and all. It's really dark.
Wow.
Nice. Somebody just tweeted me one from, Comic-Con preview day.
Okay.
Are you, speaking of Comic-Con, are you not enjoying the festivities? Do you get out there very often?
Yeah, I'm gonna go down on Friday, for Friday and Saturday, do a couple, get to present at the Eisner Awards. I'm very excited about that.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
I heard one of your favorite books is up for an Eisner, with Saga.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm praying that this time around I have the guts to bring my book and ask Fiona Staples for a drawing. Because I met her once before at a con. I think it was Denver. And I was so excited to meet her. Her work is so amazing.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I missed out on a couple of chances last couple of conventions because I didn't have my book, but for a good reason. Bill Sienkiewicz had taken it to do drawing.
Oh, well, he's out of work.
And yeah, so now I have a Sienkiewicz Batman in my book.
Nice,
awesome,
nice. So, yeah. you are a pretty big comic fan yourself, still, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the two. No, there's a bunch that people I've met, but I haven't had the guts to ask them. George Perez, Neil Adams. I have his son Josh. I had the guts to ask Josh Adams to do a drawing for me, but I haven't had the guts to ask Neil. Who else?
I just haven't had the spare cash for George.
Well, actually, and two of my, like, you know, super childhood list that I've got a Bill Sienkiewicz and a Howard Chaykin, you know, to go with my Bruce Timm. And at this point, I'm now afraid to take the book places because now it's like I might need just like a separate book because this is really valuable now.
You just have them like in an art portfolio kind of book? Is that how you're doing it?
No, it's just like a hardbound sketchbook.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
That I had with me years ago. I think my first one in there is from like 2002 or something. Mm-hmm. And I just went down to Comic-Con and I had my book with me. I remember seeing Garth Ennis at the hotel bar. And I'm like, can I get your autograph? It's like, well, it's a drawing book. Would you want me to draw something? It's like, I'm going to write it. It's like, sure. And he drew me. Did you guys ever read Hitman?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yep.
He drew me a Bator.
Oh.
Far.
See, I think Phil's got a great idea here. Instead of buying sketches and have to worry about rolling them up,
mm-hmm.
the hardcover sketchbook. Then you have your own little memory book.
Sure.
Yeah, but here's the problem is you got to give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And some of them can take most of the weekend to get it back to you too.
Right. Or 3 months.
Wow.
But now I've also got the problem of who's in the book and what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when I was working on Justice League, Kyle Baker and Dave Johnson were working upstairs. And so I heard about that, so I brought my book to a session. I was going to go upstairs afterwards. And Bruce, Tim, sees me with my book. It's like, oh, is that your sketchbook? I'm like, yeah. And it's like, does you want me to do one for you? I'm like, oh. It would never have occurred to me to even ask
him. Because you work with him, like, all the time, right?
And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
No, not to not ask him, but, like, I can't ask my boss
mm-hmm.
to draw. But he offered, and I'm like, yeah!
Since you offered.
He literally had the book for 3 months.
Oh, wow.
We were, like, coming to the end of the season. And I'm like, oh, God. What, will I never get my book back?
Do I ask him?
And then one day he just said, oh, here you go. And it was staggering.
Oh.
This piece of work, it was full color. And I don't even know what he did. It looked like a mix of pastel and marker and pencil and just, like, all this stuff. And it's a John Stewart Green Lantern in a spacescape. But done in the style of Samurai Jack.
Wow.
What?
Oh.
That's mind blown right there.
Yes. Yeah.
So now, here's the only problem with that, is when you hand another artist a book with that in it, especially if you're at a con and they're doing a bunch of stuff, and like, oh, sure, let me do a 15-minute sketch for you, and then they see that, they're all like, yo, man, no, I can't do this for 15 minutes. No, we gonna throw down. Art, you know, art macho.
Yeah, you threw out the proverbial wang onto the artist's table right there.
Exactly. The gauntlet's dropped.
So, you know, I'm feeling now like I have to get a separate book so that not everybody feels pressure to have to do something that guy took 3 months to do. because I think what? That was the problem with Sienkiewicz. He saw that one and was like, okay. I mean, not that, I think Bill works pretty slow anyway, but he was like, I'm not doing a con drawing next to that.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Well, and I think if you're looking for a Neil Adams one too, I actually am not even sure if he does con drawings anymore. I think you have to do them in advance, like go to his website and order it in advance, and he'll give it to you at the show. You got better connections than I do as far as the geek world, so I'm sure he might make an exception for you. But I know for us normal Joes, that's usually how he works these days.
Right. No. I'm working the angles. I'm working. Although it was great. I got to have dinner with him once, and he told me the story of John Stewart's name.
Oh yeah, that's a great story.
You know, and it's just amazing, like the fact that they were just going to give him like one of these standard comic book black guy names, Lincoln Jefferson or something like that. Not Lincoln Jefferson, but something like along those lines.
Yeah.
You know, a black name.
He was just like, yeah, you can't do that. That's a slave name. That's
right, exactly.
And of course, they had no idea because no idea.
Right. No. It's very funny stuff.
Neil is a great storyteller. I will say that. And the little bit I've heard of him tell a few stories, when he's in his element and he's comfortable, he can tell a good yarn.
Oh God, yeah. And just his art knowledge. You know, I remember we were in a restaurant and there was like a fabric up on the wall that was done in a medieval style. I was like, what's up with that? Like, did people not see things in perspective in the 1200s? Why is everything flat? And he went on to explain to me, like, why the art was that way and how it changed and when we started doing perspective. I'm like, I mean, it's amazing, not only the breadth of his talent, but the breadth of his knowledge.
Right.
Now, how much interaction did you have with him on, like, Justice League?
With who?
Neil Adams.
Oh, none. No. Okay. He wasn't part of that. That was all, the much younger guys. That was Dwayne McDuffie, Bruce Timm, all the Batman the Animated Series guys. Neil didn't do any work for that. I don't know if he's ever worked on any television animation.
I don't think he did, but I don't know if he had like any input with the writers or came up to talk to you guys about characters, give you more insight with the characters.
No, not that I know of. I met him years later. I'm trying to think if we met any of the DC people. Marv Wolfman was around working on Teen Titans. I think he poked his head in once or twice. But yeah, it was very much sort of removed from DC comics, and I think, and it was sort of the beginning of the DCAU, was that time. Like, they had done Superman, they had done Batman, but it wasn't really considered a universe until Justice League. And they began to create things in their own way, with their own rules, and especially the thing to me, that I think makes it so good is they have their own sense of continuity. Because one of my big problems with the comic book world, the traditional comic book world, is we are such slaves to continuity. The creators and the readers.
Yeah.
Right. And it makes no sense to me. Why should a fantastic artist and writer be a slave to some bad toy deal done in 1978 that introduced, Wing Girl, into continuity,
Yeah. But as a fan, you're still wanting the, because you have that knowledge and this happened, this experience is supposed to carry over to the next one. It's this weird back and forth. It's like, yes, continuity is cool for some, but then it can be really confusing and mind-boggling when a new person steps in there and has a new idea.
Yeah, you know what? We are comic book readers as fans of storytelling are in our infancy. We need to grow up because it's funny. The whole idea of like, well, I'm really attached to that. It's like, okay, people have been rewriting stories since time immemorial. Like the Cinderella. There are 19 different tellings of Cinderella just from the 1600s alone. Sometimes she dies. Sometimes, she kills her sisters. Sometimes her sisters chop off their feet to fit in the story changes all the time. Stories are supposed to change. Mm-hmm. And this whole idea that we have that a story must remain the same. Was 12. It's like, no, not at all. And the DCAU, what I love about them is they're not afraid to treat stories the way stories have been treated throughout history. Let's retell it. This is Superman. Okay, we're going to do a Superman who can literally push a planet in this story. Next Superman, we're going to tell a different story. We're going to use the character, the essence of that character. We're going to go back to a Fleischer Superman. We're going to do a Darwin Cook Superman who, like, leaps. You know, just because we did Superman the Animated Series, story two. It's like, well, but we've already established it. It's like, screw it. We'll establish something else. And if you like that other story, you can go back and read that, you know?
You look at the backlash of what, you know, Marvel just announced the other week where they were going to turn Thor into a lady who was going to hold the hammer for the first time. And it reminded me why I don't read comment sections, because I start going through there and it's like, you know, people start complaining and moaning and groaning. And I started thinking, I was like, you know, because it's a change and people want change, but they hate it when it happens. And exactly. And it's also the whole thing of like, I also like to take a poll of how many of these people have. When was the last time they read a Thor book to begin with? The one that
thank you.
So
right, I guarantee you, the vast majority of the people complaining about Thor don't know Lady Thor from Beta Ray Bill. They don't.
Right.
So, and the ones that do are going to buy it anyway.
Right.
If only so they can critique it more viciously.
And it's like, if you don't like it, it's the same thing as like going to any store or anything like that. If you don't like it, just don't get it. And then there's bound to be something else you can spend your money on. There's nine other Avengers titles you can go grab and enjoy just as much, probably.
Yeah, we were talking about that before show.
You know, and it's funny because, I don't know, this might just be me, because I read X-Men, I really got into it during the Chris Claremont, John Byrne years. Like, yep. Not at the very beginning, not, you know, X-Men 94, where they first, you know, I didn't know from Thunderbird, but like Hellfire Club, that was like the first story arc that I watched, that I read, and it's like, this is amazing. And that was the time that X-Men was blowing up, to the point where, I mean, I picked up New Mutants, and then I realized, like, oh, now there's six other books, Excalibur and this and that. I'm like, and I burned out. I burned out on X-Men. And to me, I get it. People want it, but I like what Marvel does with the Ultimate. Like, I love reading Ultimate Spider-Man and Superior Spider-Man. You know, two different storylines, but there's the same character, the same appeal. You know, like, yeah, tell me a different story. I'm open to that, you know? And that to me is better than like, okay, Wolverine's appearing in his eighth book this month. Just because we all love Wolverine. It's like, okay, any sense. He's in Japan and England and, you know, Genosha. Come on. And it also makes, to my mind, it makes for bad storytelling. If you're going to hobble your writers with, well, Cyclops is now the villain, so you can't have him do this. Like, you know what? Create another, you know, alternate universe where Cyclops is, you know, young and fresh and still in love with Jean. Tell those stories. If somebody has a great story set in that time with that version of the character, why should they be limited?
Right.
You know, why should it have to be a what if?
Right.
You know, just tell a different storyline.
I think my favorite Eric Larson quote was, and this is going back a few years, I can't remember if he's taking over Aquaman or something like that, but somebody asked him, was like, so are you going to carry over the storylines from the whoever was writing it before? And he's like, God, no, that sounds like a lot of extra work. Forget that.
I didn't get into this business to do homework.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I'm going to start where I think I want to start and go from there. If you did something great, I'm not going to use it, though.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, if you have a fantastic writer who writes a fantastic story arc, and then a new writer comes on, if he's got to continue someone else's work...
Yeah, it really is.
Even if he's a great writer, that's dooming him to suck.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, hey, Picasso, you're such a great artist. Do some of this Rothko stuff. It's like... Well, that's not what I do best. Like, yeah, but people love it. So just do that. No, let me do my thing, you know?
Right.
So we talked briefly about Jon Stewart. How did you end up getting the role?
It was, I mean, very straight up audition. Warner Brothers was launching a new animated series by the people who made Batman the Animated Series. So it was actually, because of that, a little hotter a ticket. I know the person who went in to read for the character ahead of me was the actor Dennis Haysbert, who played the president in the early seasons of 24. before and who's the spokesman for Allstate Insurance now.
Right.
Yeah. Allstate. You're in good hands with Allstate.
Yeah, he was just down here last year for Candlelight Processional at Epcot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we were all joking around the tech department going, how much can we raise to get him to say, you know, the Lord said to Joseph Mary, you're in good hands with Allstate.
Yeah, he's amazing. And the thing about it is, like, that's pretty intimidating to go in for Jon Stewart after a guy who literally looks like the character. Like, Dennis is like 6'4", just like a wall of just manly.
He's got that voice. You know,
voice that just like sort of rumbles under your feet. I'm like, well, dude, he's the guy. There's really no, and like, once you go in, I'm like, I can't think of any other way to do it except like him. Mm-hmm. So I basically did my version of Dennis Haysbert.
Which, you know, I always hear is like the best way to do voices is to basically do a bad impersonation of somebody. Like, and it ends up being like some of the best voices in cartoons.
Well, it's not the best way. Impression, but it is actually a really good way to, you know, come up with a new character. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, like, you know, everybody, you know, does Christopher Walken, but I can't really do Christopher Walken. But like, if I start doing Christopher Walken and then do a very bad Christopher Walken, it becomes its own sort of character, you know. I was like, wow, who's that? That's sort of interesting.
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely one of our tricks, you know. Take an impression you don't do well and use that as a jumping off point.
Yeah, what was it like being involved in the whole, I guess, roller coaster called Futurama? Yeah, y'all did the show, then it got canceled, then y'all were back. And then y'all are put in that right after Sunday football on Fox spot, and then gone, and then picked up by Comedy Central.
Yeah, well, it's funny because like, we started doing the show in 98 or 99.
Yeah.
They had the Millennium joke. That was like the first episode, I think, was about the
millennium,
new millennium hitting, I think.
Right.
New Year's Day. That's,
I mean, there. So you have to remember, we started, you know, probably a year to a year and a half before it started airing. Mm-hmm. You know, so all told, I've been living with Futurama going on, you know, heading towards 20 years.
Wow.
And it's weird because we've all done shows, you know, that have gotten canceled. You know, it's rare that you get to do one. It's rare that you, one, get to do a primetime, you know, network animated show. Those are just very rare. And it's rare that you do one that's so good, you know, with such great people. So yeah, when we first got canceled, it was really a bummer. Yeah. And also at the time when we got canceled, there was no such thing as coming back from the dead.
Right.
Like a show that was canceled cease to be. But I think because the show was that at that really cool nexus between animation and sci-fi, it's fan bait. You know what I'm saying? Like, there are a lot of shows on TV, like, you know, Everybody Loves Raymond had tens of millions of people watching every week. I guarantee you almost none of those 10 million people would throw down any money for a Ray Romano maquette. You know, it's a different level of engagement when you get into science fiction and animation. People feel much more attached to their shows. And the fact that we were kind of both, and also because the show, you know, it was Matt Groening, it was David X. Cohen, people who care. And I think people got that. Obviously not the mainstream TV audience didn't get it, at least not numbers. Or perhaps it was more the Fox executives who didn't get it and decided. It's funny that you said we were on after football. That's where you were. Out here on the West Coast, we were on against 60 Minutes.
Oh, wow.
But either way, it was a death slot.
Right.
You know?
It seemed like anything they started at 6, and it would be about one week a year that the game would actually end at 6 and your show would air. So it always would get preempted or bumped to a different time slot or something like that. So that and that's why King of the Hill, too, was another show that lasted, like, what, 12 years? But, like, I swear, like, 6 of those years it just kept getting preempted to some of us. And you never could watch it. You'd forget it was on because it never saw it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because, yeah, they were stuck down with us in the... It's funny, because we were at 7, they were at 7:30, and I swear to God, one year, Fox did a promotion. It was like, we've got the best animated shows! Primetime begins at 8! Wait a minute. We're at 7. You know, and it was like, literally, like, the biggest F you. Like, oh, you've decided we don't even count.
Ooh,
yeah. Hey, thanks.
Is that ever disheartening? Did you ever have like a time where you just could tell that the studio was just like, yeah, we're not really having faith in you. We're just kind of letting you burn out. Was there ever a time like that?
Was there ever a time not like that? Not the studio. The studio actually loved us and really supported us. And they're the ones who brought us back. But the network, I believe, had a problem with the show from day one. And, you know, like we did the very first table read and they were all like, have you ever seen the show Episodes? There's a show called Episodes. And there's this one character of the network, the comedy exec, and she's always got this face like she smelled something horrible. I don't know. That was the reaction to the first Futurama table read.
Wow.
And they sent the show back, you know, for a month of retooling. And I believe that really that was just like, it was a peeing contest. Because at that time in 98, Matt Groening was untouchable. He had built the network with The Simpsons.
Right.
And none of these executives had built the network. These were all new people coming in. He was the 800-pound gorilla they couldn't touch. They couldn't give notes on The Simpsons. Wow. And I'm sure that just ate at him. But when they finally got, it's like, oh, Matt Groening has a new little vulnerable child? And finally, Futurama was something they could mess with.
Mm.
Yeah, originally, there were two other cast members. The Leela character was played by Nicole Sullivan, and Fry was being voiced by Charlie Schlatter, like who stars as Kick Buttowski on the Disney XD now.
Right.
And they made them fire Charlie and Nicole and recast the parts.
Huh.
You know? And
right.
And although it's funny, because Katie is amazing and so super talented, but I think originally that was done as, you know, to make the network happy. Like, here, we'll take one of your stars, you know, like here, can you cross promote us now, right? You know, although it turned out to be wonderful for the show.
Yeah, because she was a recognizable voice from having been married with children for years. So I guess if anybody wasn't maybe familiar with The Simpsons for some godforsaken reason, then maybe they would tune in for Married with Children, I guess.
Which, thank you for like voicing executive think in its entire.
Right. Like, oh, sure. She was on this other show that we really liked and we wish we could air for 20 more years.
But I can totally see some executives saying what you just said and like just glossing over the fact, wait, who watching an animated show is not familiar with The Simpsons? What sort of alien world are you positing here?
Right.
So what shows in your past or that you're still working on are you still enjoying doing or enjoyed doing at the time? Well, that's not the way I wanted to ask that.
Wait, you mean shows that are still ongoing or that I haven't had to say goodbye to in a sad, teary way?
You roll higher yet?
No, I mean, because the problem is most things in show business end, you know?
Right.
We were so lucky to be able to do Futurama, you know, as long as we did. I mean, there are other shows I've done that I had a great time on. Jimmy Neutron. You know, I'm having a great time working on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles right now. I mean, I'm not in every episode, but whenever I get to go in and play in that world with, you know, Rob Paulsen and Sean Astin and, you know, and Seth Green's doing that. I mean, it's... Oh, wait, am I supposed to say that? Oh,
it's already been announced.
Oh, good. Okay, thanks. Because again, I don't know what I'm supposed to say. but that's so much fun. I mean, Ninja Turtles is great. I get to play in the Marvel world a lot. You know, I've done episodes of Hulk and the Agents of Smash with Fred Tatasciore as Hulk and, you know, Clancy Brown. I've gotten to do some Ultimate Spider-Man, which, you know, is really fun. A tiny bit bittersweet because I know that that show exists only at the cost of another show I had a great time on, Spectacular Spider-Man, you know, okay. Which was doing great, going gangbusters. Greg Wiseman is a genius, but then Disney bought Marvel.
Right.
And so we were like a corporate, you know, we were corporate collateral, you know. It's like, well, we want our own Spider-Man show. Goodbye.
So did you have that same sense or same feeling when Disney bought or merged with Lucas and here you are doing Kit Fisto with the Clone Wars?
Exactly. Same thing. It's like, oh, not this again. No, but what are you going to do? Just be happy. I mean, for me, to be a part of the Star Wars, you know, world was such a gift. I mean, how am I going to complain? Like, oh, boo-hoo, I only got to do it for 5 seasons, you know?
I would have loved to have done it for one episode.
Yeah. And you, like so many people, I mean, you look at the list of guest stars on that show. So many people had that exact same feeling. It's like, absolutely, let me just play a stormtrooper. Anything, yeah. You know?
Oh, I tried so hard when they were redoing Star Tours for Star Tours 2.0.
Oh.
I'm like, I was talking to the people involved with that going, I just want to mix for a day. Do something. I want to be involved. this secures me in the franchise somewhere because I was involved one day.
Right.
Did not happen. So I'm still looking for my way.
Bummer. Sorry.
I'm sure as you can see by my Star Wars, some of my Star Wars memorabilia behind me.
I do have a voiceover guy question for you.
Yeah.
I know it seems like a lot of people, at least, you know, that I can think of, kind of maybe attribute the movie Shrek to kind of maybe almost being like a death nail for like voiceover guys, like true voiceover guys. Do you ever look at Shrek and like say, you know, because it started casting well-known actors for all of your roles. Did it ever get harder for you around that time or like since then where it's like, oh, no. Instead of going with you, we're actually going to go with Denzel Washington instead. And you can do a great Denzel, but we need Denzel's name.
Oh, no, I don't. I think it predates Shrek. Absolutely.
I remember there being like a lot of write-ups and articles around that time. Maybe I wasn't aware of it as much for anything before that, but it seemed like that, because that was the one that made like $100 million in the summertime. It was like a huge DreamWorks, you know.
Right. Coup. Well, the funny thing is everybody forgets the 9 other celebrity stunt cast animated features that tanked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Roseanne starring in, you know, Brad Pitt in Space Treasure Island. Like, nobody wants Shrek. And also, I mean, if you really want to go to the big, I mean, I don't even think this was the beginning of it, but Aladdin.
All right.
Yeah.
Robin Williams.
Yeah.
You know, and the truth of the matter was, Robin Williams was fantastic. He made that movie, and not on his name, but on his performance. Right. You know?
Sure, wasn't Gilbert Godfrey, wasn't that? Yeah. Wasn't he also there?
Well, Gilbert was not in there for his star quality. He was there for his voice. The fact is, they were great. All of those from that movie were great, regardless. But you're right, because before that, Lion King, like, Disney didn't really stunt cast. They used a lot of on-camera actors, but it wasn't like Robbie Benson as the Beast in Beauty and the Beast. That was not, like, stunt casting. That was like, whoa, we're going to get all the Robbie Benson fans, you know? Really, I mean, DreamWorks is really, like, the home of that. Like, let's sell our celebrity voices. But Pixar does it, too, you know? Right. In my view, Pixar is actually, in some ways, even worse, because they won't cast voice actors, they'll cast themselves. You know, and like, hey, I can understand losing a job to Eddie Murphy, but the guy in rendering, come on.
Does it make your job any harder? Are you at a certain plateau now where it's you're not having to fight the job nearly as hard as maybe 10, 15 years ago?
No. What it is feature animation and TV animation are two different worlds. And to me, the problem is not Robin Williams or Mike Myers getting cast in an animated feature, because those guys are great. Anybody who makes, you know, Patrick Warburton, like anybody who does a great job in an animated feature, that's better for all of us, because that means somebody's going to make 2 more animated features. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The problem is the thinking of decision makers who look at that movie and think, oh, it did well because Mike Myers is a celebrity. As opposed to, no, because Mike Myers is a great comedic actor, you know, and Eddie Murphy, and they did a great job, you know. So they'll spend money hiring somebody from Gossip Girl instead of making the script better, you know.
Right.
And that to me is where the problem is. Or you got a casting person who goes in some article and says, well, we don't use voice actors for these movies because we need real actors. No. I mean, Ty Burrell was actually, I thought, really good in Mr. Peabody, you know? But that didn't need to be him, you know? That, to me, is different from a Robin Williams casting or an Eddie Murphy or a Chris Rock casting. Those guys do fantastic, unique stuff. And they're trading not on their name, but on their persona and their comic sensibility.
Like, when Chris Rock starts doing, you know, the zebra like this,
they write that character for Chris Rock. I don't think anybody wrote Mr. Peabody for Ty Burrell. And maybe that was the problem. Like, yep. If you're going to cast a name, you can't just be, it can't just be a name. It's got to be a persona. It's right. Got to be something that helps you make it better. Although, and again, I do think he did a really good job. And I thought he channeled the original Mr. Peabody character in a great way without aping it. Mm-hmm. You know? But, you know, I don't know.
Because I took my son to go see Planes 2 And,
right.
Like, the whole time, I'm actually, you know, sometimes I actually enjoy it when there's not well-known actors doing the voices, because then I'm like, I can get more immersed in the story. I'm not thinking about, right. Oh, this is that actor. And I, right. That's what I end up doing for most of the planes, too, was, oh, this is, you know, I'm picking out the actor by their voice, which there's a ton of in that movie, I will say. Yeah.
Are the leads names?
Dane Cook is the main plane.
Really, can you call Dane Cook a name anymore?
Well, you recognize him, so that's about it. You know?
Outside of the college world, no.
But the one that got me, I couldn't think of his name, but Ed Harris, I guess, plays the mentor role in Planes 2, and he also does the voice for the Home Depot commercials, so I kept expecting him to go, more saving, more doing, that's the power of the Home Depot, but he never did.
Now, is there a film that has used a stunt cast that you felt, you know, that was a good choice, or...
Shrek. Okay. The Shrek movies. I would totally say that, like, Mike Myers and Eddie Murphy were hilarious. And actually, I mean, and the other celebrities they use, I don't think any of them hurt that film, you know? Antonio Banderas, Puss in Boots, is great, you know? But I also think that's they spend a long time on those movies, and they rewrite them and retool them. I thought Madagascar should have used their celebrities better, you know? Like, Ben Stiller as the lion, I don't see any Ben Stiller in that character. You know, and maybe it's just that he's a good, and he did a great job. You know, he's acting wonderfully, and those movies did well. So, I mean, I can't really complain. But when you compare that to, say, Shrek fires, I mean, it's just funnier. I mean, because in Madagascar, Chris Rock is funny, but I didn't feel like Ben Stiller and David Schwimmer got to be funny in their ways in that movie. Did you?
No.
Like, anytime Jada Pinkett is as funny as Ben Stiller, somebody has fallen down on the job.
those were the scene stealers were the penguins, like, you know, as far as like the other characterizations for the right. for the other animals, I couldn't, you know, didn't really interest me. It was the penguins that really and their voice acting,
right? And again, that's not, to me, that's the writing. Mm-hmm. They wrote those characters as more interesting. Mm-hmm. and that's what people responded to, like, that's funny, that's unique.
But the main story is like, just get back to the penguin. Heck, the penguins even got their own TV show. The rest of the cast, they're still. Yeah. I think we'd be remiss if we at least didn't hit on Samurai Jack.
Yeah,
I was trying to save one of the best for last.
That I feel like really. Well, I feel like they all, I wish they all could have gone on. I wish I was doing all of the shows I've ever done. But that one, it ended too soon. Mm-hmm. We needed more.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one where I remember watching it in college because, you know, Dexter's Laboratory and Girls, and they were all on. And then Samurai Jack hit, and it was like same kind of style, but it really had its own unique kind of voice where, and I didn't notice it until several episodes in, but there's not really that much dialogue, I guess, really for any of the episodes.
No, and that's what was so amazing about it. I mean, if you watch that first 90-minute episode of Samurai Jack, the big movies thing, there is literally a 10-11 minute chunk of it where there is no dialogue, which certainly at that time was unheard of in American TV animation, you know? And the fact that the energy doesn't flag at all. I mean, Genndy Tartakovsky is amazing. And the crew that he had on that, because all the storyboard artists were the writers.
Oh, wow.
So, and it's amazing because it wasn't like one man's sole vision. He wrote every episode, you know, David E. Kelly style. It was a group collaborative thing guided by one strong hand. And he was so open, you know, like people would come in, pitch their storyboard, pitch their ideas. Like, great, that's your episode. Do it. So they all have a different sort of tone. You're all seeing different, but it feels like you're just looking at a map and seeing a different part of the world he's in. Because somehow Genndy was able to give it all a sameness, you know, so it wasn't like, wait, how does this even fit in with this other episode? That's crazy. He's in space one time, he's in a swamp the next. I don't get it. You do get it, you know? And I think part of it is Genndy understands how much there needs to be a through line. And he understands how far afield you can go, you know? Let's do one episode that is almost wall-to-wall action. Let's do one episode that's comedy, total slapstick.
But yeah, had that feel of like the old kung fu serials or something like that, where just like, you know, he shows up and this is what he needs to overcome for that day.
That's the thing. It was so deceptively simple.
Yeah.
But I think there are some ideas that are like that are so simple that they could, I think it could have gone on for almost forever. Have you guys seen the comic?
Yes.
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 That Jim Zub and Andy Soriano are doing?
Yes.
I love it. I love it.
Did they send you some copies at least, I hope?
Well, I already had them. but I got to do the foreword for the collection that they just put out.
Oh, cool.
But they collected the first few issues. So, yeah, I'm excited about that. I still have to get a hard copy of that.
Where can people find you on the internet?
I'm at philamar.com. That's my website. It's got, I post where I'm going to be appearing, if I'm doing conventions or whatnot. And it also has a few clips of, pictures from stuff of me, friends, and shoots and stuff. And also a few clips from the animated shows and some of the on-camera stuff. I'm also on Twitter, at philamar, all one word. Two L's in the middle, two R's on the end. what else? I mean, I'm on Facebook, Philamar1, facebook.com/Philamar1 is my page. Okay. Yeah, I try to keep, everybody abreast of what's going on. And those are definitely, updated pretty regularly.
And you said you're going to have a couple panels that you're involved with at San Diego Comic-Con this weekend?
Yeah. I'm going to be doing the Milestone Comics panel. I'll be emceeing that and presenting at the Eisner Awards. And then I'll be doing some signing on Friday and Saturday at the Quantum Mechanics booth and also at the Big Wow Comic Fest, which is this great con in San Jose.
Excellent.
Cool.
So that's going to wrap it up for us this week. And we thank Phil for coming on, and we definitely got to get you back. There's just a lot more stories to get into.
Yeah,
and just
now that I tend to rant.
Hey, we're okay with that.
I know we're running out of time, but I did want to ask you, like, later, some other time, about the TV show Svetlana. Because that show, I caught it just kind of randomly one time when I had DirecTV, and it captured me, and I really loved that show. And then when you popped on, and there's some other great comedians that popped up on that show, too, that I'll have to pick your brain on that some other time.
That's hilarious. You are the only person to ever ask me about that, except for the woman who played Svetlana.
Like, would you like to be on my show? Sure. Right. Maybe this guy.
That's funny.
That was just a warm-up for Weeby Geeks.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, again, we thank Phil for coming on, and I guess until next week, we bid everyone adieu, and thanks for hopping along the Geek Revolution bandwagon. So until next time.
The bad crowd you've been hanging out with is a science fiction club?
This has been a Weeby Geeks production.
The Well Watchers.
Well Watchers.
Well Watchers.
The Well Watchers.
Well Watchers.
Well Watchers.
Well Watchers.
The Well Watchers.
Well Watchers.
Well Watchers.
Check out the pop culture podcast that everyone is talking about. Follow the show on Twitter at Well Watchers. Listen to the show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and thewellwatchers.com.
Introducing Rebel Force Radio,
your source for the Force.
Star Wars news and commentary
with Jason Swank and Jimmy Mack.
I've seen Star Wars 500 times.
Weekly live shows and podcasts.
Rebel Force Radio.
You are on the front lines of fandom by listening to this show.
Jimmy Mack and Jason Swank usher in a new era of Star Wars podcasting.
Rebel Force Radio.
RFR.
Like Rebel Force Radio on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
Stay tuned for special announcements about the Rebel Force Radio official webpage.
Leaving no Star Wars fan behind.
Rebel Force Radio.
Your new source for the Force.
Welcome to the new sound of Sorcerer Radio. Version 3.0.
Sorcerer Radio presents the Sorcerer Radio app version 3.0.
We have the technology.
Check out our brand new Sorcerer Radio app for all iDevices as well as Android devices.
Better, stronger, faster.
Streaming Disney music 24/7. App highlights include a new broadcast window that shows you what you're listening to and what's coming up next.
Hot dog!
Multitasking so you can listen to SR as well as perform other tasks on your iPhone.
Gorge!
Listener access to all of our daily shows. The new interface, a new buffered stream, auto reconnect when signal is lost, visual EQ, pause, rewind, and scrub features.
My goodness!
And the new SR info area. Get your virtual Disney World fix today with the new Sorcerer Radio app version 3.0 from Sorcerer Radio.
Be careful with that. It's extremely dangerous.
SRSounds.com.
Pardon the interruption. I have some news which I believe you will find most interesting.
Would you like to hear the latest in Marvel television, film, and comic book news? Are you looking for some suggestions on what to pick up on New Comic Book Day? Well, join Mike and Ken every Saturday night at 8 p.m. on Mighty Marvel Geeks here on Sorcerer Radio, your source for all things Marvel.
There is a matter that requires your attention.
Mighty Marvel Geeks, assemble!
All wrapped up here, sir. Will there be anything else?